Brown, Peter Newfield, Susan Freeman, Matthew Wesky, Teresa Degani, Happy, Stephen Rosenfield, Petitioner Council, Alice Armstrong, Senior Assistant Attorney General for the Commonwealth.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Parissa Degani Tafti. I would like to introduce Susan Freeman, who has been admitted pro hoc vice, and I would seek permission for Susan Freeman to argue on behalf of Mr. Brown.
I didn't hear the last part of what you said. What did you say?
I respectfully request permission for Susan Freeman to argue on behalf of Mr. Brown.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Come forward. Ms. Freeman, nice to have you.
May it please the court, my name is Susan Freeman, and I respectfully request 8 minutes for a rebuttal. DNA has proven that Sherman Brown is innocent. In this case, an intimate sample was collected from the victim who was sexually assaulted by a single perpetrator, and the hospital has confirmed that sperm was recovered from inside of her body. Subsequent DNA testing has now proven that Mr. Brown is not the source of that male DNA found inside of the victim, and neither is her only consensual partner, her husband. No rational trier of fact would have found Mr. Brown guilty beyond a reasonable doubt with this new evidence, and that's because sperm is different. Sperm has the ability to persist longer over time, longer than any other biology, and sperm is hardier. And in this case, in 1969, when the victim was examined, a vaginal smear slide was created and sent to UVA's pathology department, where the pathologist visualized sperm under the microscope. Now, in 2015, DNA testing has determined that there was male DNA inside of the victim.
May I interrupt you for a moment? The Commonwealth argues that our authority is limited under 19.2, 327.1 to DNA testing by the Department of Forensic Science, and since their testing was inconclusive, that we have no authority to go beyond that.
Your Honor, this court does have the authority to grant the writ of actual innocence in this case. By precedent, this case has granted writs in four cases, Haynesworth, Diamond, Cunningham, and Montgomery. Cunningham and Barbour, excuse me. All cases where the DNA evidence was tested at Bodie.
Were the issues in those cases directly related to the issue we're now confronted with, which is a statutory language limiting the tests to be performed by the department?
If your question is, was the language in the statute exactly the same when those writs were granted?
Well, actually, my question is, did we address the legal issue in those cases that you're talking about?
No, there was no actual opinion granted, if that is the question. However, the court...
So what is the true answer, whether we did it or didn't do it, knowingly or unknowingly, inadvertently or advertently? What does the statute require? Because now we're faced with it. We have to directly address it. And the argument can't be, well, you've done it before, do it again. There's got to be something more than that.
The court... When DNA testing was granted in this case in the circuit court, the Commonwealth agreed that testing was appropriate. The court ordered the testing, and now at this point, this is the law of the case. It is too late for the Commonwealth to now make a collateral attack on this decision. Should Mr. Brown have lost his motion for DNA testing, he could not appeal. And now, although the Commonwealth may now be having regrets about the results, they can't come and collaterally attack these results. If the test results had included Mr. Brown, they certainly would not take issue with the fact that Bodie had done the ultimate testing that produced the exculpatory result.
But their argument is not that they're collaterally attacking the results. The results are whatever they are. They're saying that under 19.2, 327.3, our authority to grant the writ is limited to the tests under 327.1, which is DFS test.
Well, Your Honor, how I would respond to that is that... Yes, this court has granted writs in four of the five cases when Bodie has done the testing. And the testing did begin at DFS, and then there was a decision that they had that Bodie had a different technology that DFS agreed would be appropriate, and then the test and then there was a court order issued to send the evidence to Bodie. So it wasn't that we lab shopped, as the Commonwealth suggests. We did go to DFS, and then DFS had a conversation. The analysts at DFS had a conversation with their technical leader, who all agreed that the type of testing that we were seeking is appropriate. And then the court made a decision that this evidence should go to Bodie. And so now it is too late for the Commonwealth to collaterally attack this decision. It was ordered by the court, and the Commonwealth agreed at the time of testing.
And but may I ask you this? I mean, DNA is the key to this case because you have, you know, the victim ID, you have statements by the petitioner and so on that would be ordinarily, under the appellate standard of review, would be sufficient to sustain the conviction. One of the things the Commonwealth addresses is the chain of custody. So when you have DFS, I mean, the building is built from the ground up. It's secure, and there's all these logs, and it's very, you know, basically to defeat any chain of custody argument. Here you have a slide that's prepared essentially for pathology. It sits in a file folder. So help us with chain of custody, because that's one of the Commonwealth's arguments.
Sure, Your Honor. So in Virginia, there is a presumption of regularity for all exhibits handled by public officials. And to overcome this presumption, you need affirmative evidence of tampering or some kind of commingling of the evidence. You can't just speculate that possibly the evidence was tampered with. And the Commonwealth has failed to rebut that presumption. What we know is that the sample was created at UVA Hospital in the OR, and UVA has very strict rules for how to handle patient specimens. The slide was created in the operating room. It was then moved to the pathology department, and then afterwards was stored at UVA's long-term storage facility, where it holds all of its patient specimens. And Dr. Moskaloff, the chair of the Department of Pathology at UVA, has explained how this slide was stored.
Did Bodie test for the victim's DNA on the slide sample?
Bodie did YSTR testing,
right,
and that only tests for the male chromosome. The initial round of testing did test for general DNA, for autosomal testing, which can target any DNA that's in the sample, and that ended up with DFS ended up with a with no results. They had results at one allele at one locus, which is not sufficient to make any kind of conclusions either way.
So we don't actually have any DNA testing confirming that the victim's DNA was on the slide that had a label that it was hers.
Well, the reason why that happened, and I will also return to your question about the chain of custody, is that this slide is 46 years old. It has degraded. That doesn't take away from the reliability of the data. It just limits the amount of data that we have. And so the victim's DNA, which would have been present with epithelial cells, degraded while the sperm maintained on the slide. Because of its cell morphology, it's able to sustain for longer periods of time. Now, in terms of the chain of custody, as I return to that point, what has happened there is that Ms. Crawford, who was the administrative assistant at pathology who found the slide, explained that she went to the secured facility that UVA owns, and she had to enter it with a badge, and then when she entered that facility, there was a chain-linked fence that held all the patient specimens, and she needed a key to enter through into that area. When she got there, she searched the logbooks. She found the victim. In the logbook, she found the victim's name, the victim's patient specimen number, and the location for where the slide would be located. When she went to exactly where the slide was supposed to be located, it was right there. And she found the slide with the patient identification number. It was completely intact. There was nothing to suggest that it had been damaged. And within an hour, it was turned over to law enforcement. At no time was the slide in the custody of anyone besides law enforcement or UVA hospital. Mr. Brown has clearly satisfied the chain of custody in this case.
And again, because at least to me, the DNA issue is key. And this is, I mean, I litigated DNA issues as a lawyer, and I've seen plenty of it as a judge. But there's this suggestion that because of the age of it, it may be that, and it, of course, predated, you know, some of the DNA technologies that we have that are much more advanced. So perhaps in handling it, some medical techs or doctors or nurses may have contaminated the slide.
So if I may just take a moment to explain how the slide would have been created, given what we know about how vaginal smear slides must be created. So while the victim was in the operating room being treated, where individuals in the operating room are gloved and are gowned, they called GYN services in because there was a concern. Obviously, all the evidence pointed to the fact that she was sexually assaulted. The doctor came in, and the way a vaginal smear is created is by using a vaginal swab, which essentially looks like a long Q-tip. It has a very long wooden handle, and it's inserted into the female genitalia, and from the cervix, they remove cells. Then the slide had to be made immediately because the point of a vaginal smear slide is that the swab must be wet when you make it. So contrary to what the Commonwealth has stated in its papers, the swab didn't transfer or travel all through the hospital. Immediately in the OR, they had to have created that slide, at which point then it was moved to the pathology department. And the idea that perhaps somebody, I mean, they were wearing gloves, but even putting all of that aside, the idea that somebody who may have come into some kind of incidental contact with the slide left one or two cells behind, and that is the contamination that we're seeing, that's just illogical. That doesn't make any sense. Because if that were the case, there's no way that we would see those cells and not the cells of the sperm donor, which were present in a greater quantity. If anything, we would see a mixture. And Bodie has definitively concluded that there is nothing in the data to suggest that
this slide... Which one of your experts testified to what you just told us? Where
Bodie,
would I find that?
So the Commonwealth, in their motion to dismiss, filed Commonwealth's Exhibit 29, which is an exhibit that was created by the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth has not presented any expert evidence supporting any of the speculations that they have made.
Which one of your experts testified to what you just told
us
as to how we can be certain that this slide was not contaminated?
Yes, I'm going to... I'm just addressing your question. And so what we know, so you want to know why we know it's not contaminated as opposed to that it's a single source.
Just went through a lengthy recitation of how it's collected, how we can be sure it was not contaminated. I want to know in which of the expert proffers you gave us, which one of us tells us that.
Yes, Your Honor. So the Commonwealth, first of all, initially argues that this slide could have been contaminated at any point from 1969 until 2015 when it was tested. And the record doesn't support that. Dr. Moskaloff, the chair of the Department of Pathology at UVA, and Dr. Arden, a very well-renowned forensic pathologist, both submitted affidavits that stated, absent any evidence that the slide has been damaged, there is no possibility for contamination while the cover slip was affixed. And that's because the purpose of the cover slip is to protect the human biology. That's how they maintain these slides for decades. That's how the hospital does this. This has been a routine practice for over 40 years. And what we know, when the slide was found, Ms. Crawford confirmed that the slide was completely intact, the cover slip was intact, and likewise, DFS confirmed that when they received the slide, it was completely intact and the cover slip was intact. Then the only other two possibilities for contamination that the Commonwealth has alleged is that, well, maybe it was contaminated during the testing process in 2015, but that could not have occurred here either, because both at DFS and at Bodie, the samples were processed by females, so they could not be the source of the male DNA profile that we have here. Then, finally, the only other possible consideration, which is an extraordinarily remote potential possibility, is that the slide was contaminated prior to the cover slip being affixed. And as I said, the idea that someone who may have come into some kind of incidental contact left behind one or two epithelial cells, and that is the DNA profile that we are seeing, it just doesn't make sense. What
may
we would see
interrupt
is
you with another question on an unrelated point. He went to the parole board in, what, 1984, is that right?
That's correct.
And he appeared to accept responsibility. He gave facts that only the perpetrator could have known because there was no one else there but the victim and the perpetrator. He expressed extreme remorse. He said he had blood all over him. He said he had the knife handle in his hand. The knife itself was in her. How do we ignore that? Those are not the statements of a man persisting in a claim of innocence.
Your Honor, so two responses. First, people that go to the parole board face an impossible choice. Everyone knows that you have to admit some kind of remorse and accept responsibility for it to even be considered for parole. We've had dozens of people who have been exonerated by DNA evidence who have gone in and told the parole board they were factually guilty of crimes and provided details that corroborated the crime, and then DNA proved that they are innocent. Second, he actually didn't provide any details that he didn't hear at the trial. Let's remember, Mr. Brown sat through this evidence three times. At the preliminary hearing, he heard the victim's account. Then at the trial, he heard the victim's account. And then again, when he was resentenced in 1973, he heard the victim's account again.
When we do the analysis of looking back retrospectively and ask ourselves whether a rational fact finder would have convicted under these circumstances, the statute and the rule says that we look at the Commonwealth's response, which can go outside the record, obviously outside the trial record, in the same way we look outside the record for DNA. So if a jury, a rational jury, were to hear the allegedly the DNA argument and the counter-responsive DNA argument and the 40 years of no chain of custody and all those arguments, and then hear what he said to the parole board, you think a rational jury, we could say with confidence, on clear and convincing evidence, a rational jury would not have convicted him?
No, I don't think, in light of the new DNA evidence, I don't think a rational juror would convict Mr. Brown. And that's because they would hear about the power of the DNA evidence. If this was an intimate sample that was collected from inside of the victim's body, there is no evidence that this slide was tampered with. And we know why people make inculpatory statements. And just to go back to your question.
How do we know she was even penetrated to begin with?
We know that the victim was...
She doesn't remember anything.
We know that the victim was raped for a number of reasons. First, the perpetrator had told the victim, asked her a few times that he asked whether or not she would have sex with him. And the last thing she remembers is him saying, "I'm so sexed up, I don't know what to do." She was wearing underwear when she had answered the door, and when she was found, her underwear was removed.
So maybe it was a sexual assault, but no penetration, and thus no vaginal sperm.
Well, the key to this is the fact that the hospital said there was sperm, and we know that her husband, her only consensual partner, was excluded as well. So the record points to the fact that she was sexually assaulted, and that was the motive. That was the alleged motive for the killing of the child.
Sexual assault doesn't necessarily mean intercourse and penetration. And we have a case where there actually wasn't an allegation of actual penetration rape. It wasn't the charge.
But we did have sperm found inside of her, and the sperm does not belong to her husband. And so the only conclusion that we can come to is that the sexual assault was a rape.
Well, other than the label, we don't even have DNA that is hers.
That is because the victim's DNA over 46 years has degraded, and the only DNA that we have seen that has remained is the sperm donors. I'd like to respectfully ask I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Alice Armstrong on behalf of the Commonwealth. The Court should deny relief in this case because Brown is asking this Court to grant him a statutory remedy, but he has not satisfied all of the mandatory requirements of the statutes he invokes. Under 19.2327.5, Mr. Brown bears the burden of proof throughout. The burden never shifts to the Commonwealth. It is his burden to carry throughout these proceedings, and he must carry that burden by clear and convincing evidence. There are functionally two arguments before the Court today, one procedural, one substantive. Hopefully I can divide my time equally between those two points. As a procedural matter, the claim fails at the threshold because Mr. Brown has not and furthermore cannot satisfy the mandatory requirement that he present test results to this Court under 19.2327.1, which I referred to in the papers as the testing statute. The testing statute requires two pivotal things that are critical in this case. It requires a valid chain of custody, and it requires testing and testing results by DFS. Mr. Brown has not satisfied those two requirements, and he cannot satisfy those two requirements. Turning to the chain of custody, which I think has been raised already, let me back up one moment. The argument this morning, the proffer this morning, was that it's too late for the Commonwealth to suggest that this was an improper procedure or that he isn't bound by the requirement that he present testing under the testing statute because the Commonwealth attorney acquiesced to his request. It is settled law in this jurisdiction that the Attorney General is not bound by prior acquiescences, agreements, etc., by the Commonwealth Attorney. We cited In re Department of Corrections. The second point that was raised was that this is somehow the law of the case. The law of the case doctrine doesn't apply if I didn't have a prior opportunity to appeal that I forewent.
Well, it certainly doesn't apply when we're sitting in our original jurisdiction.
Indeed not, because he has to come in with evidence that this court is the fact finder. He has to present evidence to this court. But either way, the argument is not well taken. The Commonwealth, through the Attorney General in these original jurisdiction proceedings, absolutely can say to the court that this petitioner has not met his statutory obligation. And here he has not. There is not a valid chain of custody in this case because we're missing vital links. I cited to the court in the papers, and I cite today, the Robinson case, which I think is very similar. We're missing the vital links here. We don't know, and counsel has never addressed, we don't know who collected this sample. There was a representation that was made this morning that this slide was created in the OR. There's nothing in the record to suggest that. Nowhere in the record does it say where this slide was created. Nowhere. On page 118 of the transcript, Dr. Aldrich testified to the jury. This is the sum of the testimony concerning the chain of evidence of this slide. At the instruction, I guess, of the sheriff, we called the GYN service to make an exam. The next thing we know, which is that petitioner's exhibit C in the record, the next thing we know is that a slide was received in the pathology department. We don't know. Presumably it was received on October the 2nd. That's what the date is on that piece of paper. That didn't come directly from the OR. It couldn't have, because her spleen, which is also, there's another piece of paper from the pathology department. Her spleen was received on October the 1st. But this slide didn't make it to the pathology department until October the 2nd. We don't know who collected the swab. We don't know who prepared the slide. We don't know. There is no evidence in the record to support the allegation that that slide was immediately prepared in the OR. That is great conjecture.
Is there any evidence that the victim's DNA is even on the slide?
There is no evidence that the victim's DNA is on the slide. The tiny bit of evidence that we do have was the Paraplex DNA testing that DFS did, which they didn't carry forward because it wasn't sufficient information, is inconsistent with the victim.
So the one allele would be inconsistent with the victim. So if that were the standard, if Bodie were to say that were the standard, then under his interpretation of the standard, it would have excluded the victim.
Exactly.
Did the Bodie laboratory even do their own analysis of whether or not the victim's DNA was on the alleged victim's vaginal slide?
Not as far as I understand the evidence, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that be something you'd want to do to confirm that, in fact, we're dealing with the right slide instead of some mislabeled slide that no one knows where it came from?
I would think that that's what one would want to do, to, especially in a situation like this where we don't know where the thing has been for more than 40 years, and we don't know who's handled it. And again, citing the Robinson case, we don't know who collected this. We don't know what happened to this. We don't know that that immediately happened in the OR and that the label was immediately affixed.
But ideally, chain of custody, you've got every link and you've got your witnesses lined up. But we haven't required perfection. Is there enough with the presumption of the public officials follow, you know, and the hospital policies and all that? Could we string all that together and say, well, we're the fact finder, we can draw an inference that chain of custody is satisfied?
I don't think so. I think if this slide was being presented just as a demonstrative for whatever reason, then that would be different. I think that the standard is a little bit different. But when you're relying on a piece of evidence for subsequent forensic examination to then present those testing results, no. I don't think that you can string together those inferences. And I think Robinson is very on point, and I probably will be filing a letter because I found a probably even better case last night, but it was too late to file a letter. when you're relying on these analyses, the chain of custody requirements are a little bit heightened. And I'm not suggesting, the Commonwealth does not suggest, that they have to say which orderly carried the slide from one place to the next. But what I am saying is they do have to identify who collected the slide and where, who collected the swab, first of all. Because I think it's important that we are clear on what this evidence is, and I want to turn to that in just a moment. But I don't think that there's a relaxed standard on the vital links. And the jurisprudence of this Commonwealth is you don't get the presumption of regularity for the vital links. You get the presumption of regularity for, you know, the mail guy carried it to the right place, the orderly who's tasked with carrying all the specimens from point A to the pathology lab did his job correctly. That's what the presumption of regularity covers. The presumption of regularity doesn't excuse the vital links, which is what's missing here.
So that I'm clear as to what link you argue is missing, you're arguing that the evidence as to who actually collected the swab in the OR is missing? Or I'm looking at Dr. Muskalic's affidavit, and it talks about the material is submitted as identified with the patient's name, medical record number, identification numbers, tracked, transferred to the medical labs. So you're saying something prior to that is missing?
I'm saying we don't know who collected the swab. That's what's missing. And we don't know who made the slide or the circumstances. I mean, that's really the critical part, the circumstances under which this slide, which is actually what was tested, we don't have the swab. The circumstances under which this slide was created. I mean, there's been a suggestion that it was created right there in the OR, but no evidence supports that. There's nothing in the record that says that. And the problem with Dr. Musk's thing is he can't say what happened in 1969. He wasn't there. He has no idea. And neither do I. None of us does, but that's part of the problem. But the second part, if I may, the second part of the testing statute is that DFS has to do the testing. And they didn't. Well, they did do testing. I'll correct myself. They did testing, and it was inconclusive. Under our testing statute, that's the end of the inquiry. There's no provision in the testing statute or the actual innocence statutes for independent testing by some other lab that he picked. And the distinction between the cases that he would like to rely on and this case is that in those cases, Bodie was working under contract to DFS. All of DFS's standards applies. DFS's analysts reviewed the data that Bodie collected and rendered an independent judgment as evidenced by the certificates of analysis that DFS issued under its own auspices, signed by its own analysts, and we put those certificates of analysis.
I mean, the statute sometimes will specify a sanction like an exclusion, you know, or whatever. So in other words, no testing from anywhere else shall be admitted. Here it just says DFS. It was done elsewhere. So without more express guidance, with respect to exclusion or inclusion, do we have some discretion to say, well, under these peculiar circumstances, and the fact that Bodie is hardly, I mean, they're not some Mickey Mouse lab, you know, that's where folks aren't qualified and they're not used to doing it or whatever.
Well,
do we have some discretion to say, well, let's look at it anyway?
No, I would say expressio unis. The statute says what the statute says. The legislature plainly knows how to say that independent testing or further testing is permitted. They've done it in the DUI statute. They've made express provision for it. Here they have not. This is in derogation of Rule 1:1. It's in derogation of the common law. It implicates the separation of powers because this is comes close to a judicial pardon. I'm not going to say that, but it implicates the separation of powers. The legislature has struck a very careful balance. These are post-conviction proceedings.
Under the separation of powers doctrine, executive clemency is still an option if there is a lack of an option under the AI statute. So each branch of the government has its role.
Exactly so. But I would say that the legislature has said that this branch's role is limited to things that expressly satisfy the statute. And if I could turn unless there are other questions concerning the procedural point, I would like to turn to the substantive argument, and that is simply this, that the evidence proffered here does not bear the weight that Mr. Brown assigns to it. And I think it's important to step back for a moment and place this case among the cases that he's trying to compare himself to, namely the four petitioners who have been granted relief in this court. Because there are several key and very important differences between those cases where the Commonwealth has agreed to relief and, might I say, has been quick to agree to relief, and this case. In all of those other cases, DFS reported the results that the petitioners relied on in seeking relief. And we've put those in evidence at Commonwealth 33. Here, it did not. In all of the other cases, there was a valid chain of custody that was apparent on the face of the record. Here, there is not. In four out of the five other cases, well, in three of the four cases under the case file review and also in the Harvard case, which I know the court is familiar with because it's the most recent, we could confidently say that the victim was associated with the evidence that was tested because the victim's DNA was identified in the samples that were tested and reported on. So
that's what bothers me, is why the Bodie results didn't even attempt to determine if the victim's slide belonged to the victim.
Right. Well, and there's more than that, right? This is, they contend that this evidence is from a vaginal swab. Her DNA should be there even in a degraded sample. Because what we know is the reason that we have YSTR testing is that in these types of samples, otherwise, if we're not only looking at YSTR, otherwise the female DNA overwhelms the male DNA. But there's nothing here that we can identify to her. And we also know that the no value profile that DFS did get is inconsistent with her DNA profile. And there is a DNA profile for her. They took a presumptive DNA profile from the nightgown, and I would note that that's actually consistent with one with what the profile that DFS developed is consistent with the presumptive profile that one of the other private labs did in some of the earlier rounds of testing. So we know that that presumptive DNA profile for the victim has been consistent across two labs, DFS and this other lab, NMS. That's Exhibit M.
Was there any direct evidence, or for that matter, circumstantial evidence, of vaginal penetration by the attacker?
No. Going back to the comparison with the other cases, in all the other cases, the samples that were tested and reported on were sufficiently robust that DFS was actually reporting on the sperm fractions from these differentially extracted DNA samples. All of those other cases involved the sperm fraction from the samples. This isn't a sperm fraction. This is from the epithelial cell fraction. And they have a lot of explanations for why it might theoretically be possible for sperm cell DNA to be only in the epithelial fraction. But that rank conjecture or that bare possibility is not clear and convincing evidence that no rational trier of fact would convict beyond a reasonable doubt in light of the record evidence. And finally, in all of the other cases, the samples were from the direct evidence. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is the actual vaginal swabs and or the victim's clothing. That's not what we have here. That's not what we have here at all by a wide, wide margin. Here's what we have. We have, we think, we presume that a vaginal swab was taken in the operating room. Sometime, some kind of way, a vaginal smear slide was prepared and received in the pathology department, previously prepared. It was sent for staining, and it was stained. And my understanding of this staining process is that it's a multi-step, I mean, it almost looks like, I don't know if the court is familiar with it, I had to look it up. It's almost like dipping these things into egg decorating, you know, when you're egg dyeing for Easter. It's a whole series of baths of these different dyes that are then affixed to this thing. Then they put some glue on it, then they glue a cover onto it. DFS got that, and they scraped it and they swabbed it. And they took the scrapings and the swabs and they subjected those to differential extraction. So I'm not a scientist. It's hard for me to picture these things. It's like making soup. DFS took a little bit of the soup and they made a new slide to see if they could find sperm. They didn't find any. They took some of the soup and they subjected it to DNA analysis and they got one locus, one allele. Then what happened? Then the rest of the soup went to Bodhi. And Bodhi took the rest of the soup.
And am I correct that one allele didn't match the victim? Is that
correct?
Okay.
They took the rest of the soup and they subjected that to what is called minifiler DNA testing, which is specific for degraded samples. And they got no results. Then what they did was they re-swabbed the slide that DFS had already scraped and swabbed. And they swabbed the slide that DFS created when they took a little bit of the soup and were looking for sperm. And that's what Bodhi subjected to differential extraction. And again, got no result on the sperm fraction and got less than 0.001 nanograms per microliter of DNA in the non-sperm fraction. And that is what they tested. That is what they're reporting on. That is the evidence that he presents to this court. That isn't enough. That's not good enough. We don't know where that 0.001 nanograms per microliter of DNA came from, and neither does Bodhi, and neither does Mr. Brown, and it is not clear and convincing evidence that no rational trier of fact would convict Mr. Brown, given that, in light of the victim's eyewitness identification that it was him and shamed him. And it was conceded today that the perpetrator said he wanted sex. Well, she said that was Mr. Brown. And Mr. Brown made inculpatory statements to the parole board, but Mr. Brown also lied to Deputy Bailey about where he was that day. And that evidences his guilty knowledge. And a reasonable fact finder would consider that. And in light of all of that evidence, unless the court has other questions, we ask the court to deny the writ. Thank you.
Ms. Friedman?
Thank you. There are a few things I want to respond to because there seems to be some confusion here. So the Commonwealth is correct. They are not a scientist. And although I appreciate the explanation for how this DNA testing occurred, they have not presented one expert to support all of these speculative arguments that they are making. And there are a lot of experts in this country that they could have turned to. And so first, their argument that the single allele that was identified that does not belong to the victim, that's because the only DNA on the slide belongs to the male. That 8 belongs to the male perpetrator. That is why it doesn't match the victim. Second, the Commonwealth is relying extensively on Robinson, which is a case from 1955. And the facts in Robinson are completely different from the facts in Brown.
Can I back you up very quickly?
Sure.
Are you saying that there is no female DNA capable of being determined from the slide?
There has been no identification of female DNA, and that's because the cells that are produced, that are put on the slide, are what are known as epithelial cells, which have a different cell morphology than sperm, and they degrade more rapidly.
Did Bodhi attempt to find that?
Bodhi did. They did minifiler, as the Commonwealth had said, and there were no results on that. And so the male DNA, the one allele that was identified belongs to the male. That's the only DNA left on the slide. And then the Commonwealth is relying extensively on Robinson, which is a case from 1955 where the facts are completely different and not applicable here. In Robinson, they took a blood sample from someone to identify, to determine whether or not he had alcohol. present in his blood. That tube of blood was not labeled, and then it was just put in the mail, and the nurse who mailed it could not tell them where they even mailed it to, which lab they sent it to. So basically, some unlabeled tube arrived in a lab, and they determined that there was alcohol present, and then they wanted to prosecute the defendant in that case. This is completely different. This has a logbook that has the patient's name, the unique identification number that is on both the pathology report and in the logbook, and then on the slide. There is no question that this is a slide that was created in connection with this case. And in terms of the fact that we don't know who created this slide, it was created by Dr. Flanagan. They called GYN in, and on that pathology report, it says Dr. Flanagan submitted this slide. He is the person who took it. He
Let me
is
ask
submitting
you this real
doctor.
Quick. The Commonwealth points out it's 0.01 microgram, which to this non-scientist seems very teeny tiny. Is there any DNA scientific significance to the fact that it was a very small sample?
No, Your Honor. What happens is that, first of all, there are a number of studies that say you can quant at zero and still obtain a profile. Labs go on to continue testing even at zero. And, in fact, people are prosecuted where they get a partial DNA profile with a zero quant. The only limitation is that it will limit how much data you get. But that doesn't in any way undercut or underscore the reliability. Bode is a very reputable lab. They work with DFS. They upload profiles for DFS. DFS uploads profiles to CODIS for Bode. There is no indication that this is a lab that doesn't follow the protocols. And in this case, the Commonwealth is undermining the role that Bode played in the other testing. They did the important testing. They did the important work. If this court wants to know what DFS thinks, they can certify this case to go down to the circuit court for DFS to review the testing. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your argument. Call the next case.